Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife with ecologist Scott Craven. We're going to be talking about the deer hunting season. We'll get your home and yard ready for all the snow, at least for the birds, and then cooking with wild game and a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join the conversation. Maybe you've got a deer hunting story. Maybe you have a question about the birds and feeding birds. Maybe you have something that's gotten into your house or garage with a sudden snowfall that you didn't have time to take care of. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back, and happy holidays to everybody.
Yeah, here we've got all our animals getting ready for winter. And they better be ready.
Including us. They better be ready. It's here.
Some of them have, you know, amazing ways to survive these cold months.
Well, they do, and I think being human, we tend to look out the window into the frigid environment and think, oh my gosh, those poor birds at the feeder or the poor deer wandering around. But the reality is they're adapted to that, to these conditions, and they've survived it for years, and they'll survive this year just fine too. It may not be especially comfortable, not like lying around on a nice warm fall afternoon, but they've got strategies. Some migrate, some hibernate, some just stay out of harm's way during the winter, and they've put on enough fat and energy resources that most of them will make it through the winter just fine. But there's no getting around the fact that winter is the bottleneck for wildlife populations, and that's when some mortality occurs and the populations reach their seasonal or yearly lows at the end of winter, leading into the breeding season. So the system's worked for time immemorial, and it will continue to work. And, you know, if we do our part to help out a little bit by feeding the birds or, shoveling a trail that the animals, whatever we can do is great and makes us feel good. And if truth be known, I think the animals utilize those kinds of things. So
I was talking to somebody, this is a few years ago now, there was a huge snowstorm, and he was going hunting, and he had a tree stand, and he went through the woods and so forth, but he had to make this big trail to get to his tree, and he got up in his tree, and it wasn't much later than a bunch of deer
followed his trail.
His trail right up to his tree.
And he poured in a storm.
Oh my gosh. Well, and we did see a bear that would look just rolling in fat. You're right. They put on a lot of fat. How was the deer hunting season for you, by the way?
It was great from the standpoint of, you know, my son was here from Colorado with his son, so we kind of had three generations traveling around, and we were able to hunt on opening day with my son-in-law at the camp he's established over in southwestern Wisconsin. But, you know, as you know, the farm that we'd all been hunting on for me, 51 years, was sold a couple of years ago, and that still stings a little bit. But on the other hand, that's right at the focal center of CWD, so I've kind of lost interest in hunting in that region anyway. Anyway, we had a nice time opening day. No deer were harmed in the production of opening day from our standpoint. But we had some good food and camaraderie. And then my son and I and grandson took off Sunday morning, drove up to Door County, completely different environment, and a beautiful property, and, you know, not a lot of hunting pressure. And we had a great time. Sunday night we went out, and we didn't sit very long before my son had a doe and a buck, and I said, well, that's all we wanted. I'll pack up and come get you. And, you know, that was the end of it, and we drove home on Monday and then took some time to enjoy Thanksgiving and do some things around the house before we got buried alive at the end of the week. So it was relatively uneventful. The most important thing for me is just seeing the difference now in the 9-day gun deer season, which, I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's still a big event. It's still very important, ecologically and economically, a whole host of other things, but it's not the same as it was even 5 or 10 years ago, let alone 10 or 20. We drove, as an example, on Sunday, second day of the deer season, opening weekend, we drove from Madison to northern Door County and saw one orange coat in a fence row. One.
Yeah.
No one, nobody in cars. We didn't see a car or truck with a dead deer.
Yeah.
Nothing. I'm thinking, have we got the wrong weekend here? What did we do? And you know, you remember, as do I, when the roads on opening weekend were choked.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, the northbound interstate to get up to the Northwoods 30 years ago. It was an event to go watch the traffic. And that just doesn't happen anymore. So, you know, deer camps have gone by the boards. People have switched to other seasons, of which there are many. If you really want to hunt, it opens September 15th and it goes in some places well into the winter. So there's plenty of opportunity, and I guess the hunters have assorted themselves to those various opportunities. So the pressure of opening day, there were certainly people out there, but deer are not moved around like they used to. Deer drives seem to have gone by the boards. You know, you have the same long history with a piece of property that I do, and the change is
significant.
Is really remarkable.
Roy in Whitewater has a question about deer, not about deer hunting, I don't think. Roy, what's on your mind?
I am the owner of a small choose-and-cut Christmas tree farm.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've been thwarted by male deer taken to my evergreens and wrecking them with their antlers during the rut. I had picked up on a hint years ago to thwart or to keep deer away, whether during the velvet thing or the rut, by using human hair. And I have a clothesline around my two fields with hair net holdings of barbershop or beauty parlor hair. It's worked perfectly. I haven't had a destroyed tree in 2 years. The question is, I drop the line when people come to choose their tree, which was last weekend. I'm done. The snow has buried the hairline, as I call it. And I'm wondering, is it worth me putting it back up again, or are these fellas done monkeying around out there?
Well, I guess the proof will be in the pudding, Roy, as you're still selling trees now leading up to Christmas, if you start to see any damage. And I don't think you will. The short answer to your question is the rut is pretty well over.
Yep.
The deer have already polished their antlers. And realistically, 100,000 of them are dead. So there are a number of factors conspiring here to suggest that you can probably leave your hairline buried and get through the season here. And then when things moderate in the spring sometime, it looks like, from the temperatures, it looks like the snow is going to be with us for quite a while. But anyway, once you can get in there and reestablish it for the next growing season, you should be fine. And I'm pleased to hear it's working well for you. Human hairs, the trick has been around for a long time, but it works well for some people and not so well for others. If it's working for you, keep up the good work.
Yeah.
But I don't think you need to worry about much going forward. On my own property, there are lots of buck rubs around, but they haven't been tended or looked at for several weeks, and I don't expect to see any new ones. So I think you're okay.
Yeah, I think you're okay, Roy. Thank you very much for calling. Christy in Dunn County, your turn. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Thanks a lot. So this is only an anecdotal story question, and that is, so our property on the lower Chippewa River, just upstream from Duran, we've been there for, I don't know, 4 decades plus. We saw many fewer deer this year than ever and harvested many fewer. And I realize that's just an anecdote. Have heard similar stories, but then the numbers over the state were down just a little. The Friday evening before opening, we were down in Tyrone and saw like 90 deer there. And last year, Saturday opening weekend, my niece and I counted 34 in an alfalfa field. And my little theory is with more activity earlier in the year with new compound bows and more people getting out, maybe we've disrupted the pattern.
Maybe.
What do you think?
So, longer seasons, the compound bow, or the crossbow start, that's now very popular. The season starts so early. I think what Christy's getting at is, has this caused a change in behavior in the number of deer? I mean, the number of bow hunters kill is pretty high every year.
Well, yes, and there have been a couple of recent really nice summaries in Outdoor News that describe how the bow hunting pressure, especially with the advent of crossbows for all, has increased, but not to explain some of the differences we're seeing. The archery kill is still, while it's a lot of deer, you have to remember that just prior to the season, they were talking about a herd estimate of 1.85 million prior to, that was last, at the end of the winter.
Yeah.
So if you add, I think the statistics show, and I think I saw something in the paper, that it's about a 30% increase once reproduction and early form. So you add 600,000 to that, we were looking at a heck of a lot of deer going into the deer season.
Mm.
So the harvest, which was just reported on the news, but I have the numbers if anybody wants to hear them again, we did not cut out the annual growth, and there was some interest in reducing the herd, especially in the central farmland units. Most of the deer population is from, say, Highway 10 line across from Green Bay down to, north of Dane County, Columbia County, in there, but in that central area. And there were some tremendous deer densities there, and probably still are. So it's not a uniform thing across the state. As you well know, you hunt in the North Woods, you did not see a deer on opening day.
No.
I hunted in the heart of CWD country, and although we knew deer were around from the trail cameras and whatnot, I didn't see much, not compared to what I was used to. So the hunting pressure has changed. Deer are not being moved around and by deer drives and things like that so that they're more visible, whether it's for hunters seeing them or someone driving down the road. So their behavior has changed a little bit. Personally, I feel, at least around my place, that because they are pressured or pursued to some degree from September through the winter, that they've become a little more cautious than they perhaps once were, and their behavior is around me almost entirely nocturnal. We hardly see one during daylight anymore. So there have been a lot of changes that affect what people actually see, and so it's difficult to kind of balance it, hearing about 2 million deer or whatever the huge number is, and then all of a sudden your group shoots little or nothing, we have trouble finding deer and so forth. So it depends really where you are.
Yeah.
It's the long and short of it.
Christy, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too with your questions. Maybe it's about birds. Maybe it's an interesting experience you've had with wildlife. Maybe it's something else related to the outdoors. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife on the show today with Scott Craven. Always a great pleasure to have him with us. 12:30 today, we'll talk about making delicious meals out of white game with Madison-based chef Joel Olson back once again. Always nice to see him come by. But right now, question about the wildlife here in our state, or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. Natalie in Menominee, Michigan emailed us. Are there any edible plants that can be harvested during winter here, if even under the snow? And if so, what are they, and how are they harvested and used?
I'm trying to think of something. I know around my own yard there are still some residual garden plants that, like parsley and things like that, that stand up to winter weather. And if I leave some onions or carrots in the garden, I know they're going to be there for a while, especially now with the insulation of snow. But in terms of wild stuff, I mean, most of it's frozen back.
Yeah.
So what's there is dried. I'm at a loss. I suppose if things aren't frozen solid in the wetlands, you might get in and find some cattail tubers or some things like that in a wetland. But boy, stuff is freezing up fast, and it's going to freeze up really fast tonight, from what I heard on the weather. So, short of getting under the leaf litter and snow, and finding some sort of tubers or corms or roots or whatever, I can't think of anything else.
No,
but that's a good question for the listeners.
It's a good question. Maybe somebody else has had some experience with that. It might be fun to hear. I mean, if I still had some carrots in the garden, I wouldn't hesitate to go out and dig a couple up, because they're probably pretty good.
They are, and I used to mulch a couple of rows so that I could dig them either, first thing in the spring and have fresh carrots then, or some other root crops like parsnips and whatnot are known for that and supposedly get sweeter as they stay in the ground. But I guess I'm wondering what the motivation really would be. Most of my foraging this time of year is in the produce section of the grocery store. So.
Okay. Well, David in Bayfield has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I hung up in northern Bayfield County, and around what I wanted to see is around the big Chulalongkorn National Forest in the Barrens area, the deer numbers are so low compared to they were even 15, 20 years ago. All the deer hang by all the ag fields down in the Ino and Mason areas, but in the public, there just isn't the deer numbers anymore. It was a very tough season for the guys hunting on public land.
Well, that's where I hunt.
that's Larry and lots of other people. And there, of course, there have been concerns about deer numbers relative to forestry practices, where they're gravitating to agriculture, as you pointed out, where are the wolf packs, that kind of thing. But there are a lot of things conspiring right now to depress activity in the northern forest. And in the southern forest, where CWD is turning some people off, and as I said, it's in the ice cream and the ice cream sandwich in the middle of Wisconsin, the middle two-thirds of the state, where the really high deer densities seem to be right now. But somebody who's a non-hunter would say, well, the hunters should just go there, but it's not that easy. Access is, of course, an issue. That's mostly private land, whereas the attraction in the Northwoods has always been, hey, it's mostly public land.
National Forest.
Go up there and wander around wherever you want and have a great time. But that's not the case in privately held agricultural land, where most of those farms have regular deer groups or family groups or whatever else, which is great, too. That's part of the whole tradition. But it's not easy for a non-land-holding city dweller to just find a new spot.
Yeah, absolutely. And, David, I've spent 60 years in the same, I don't know, five-acre area about a mile off a road in the Chulalongkorn Forest, and things have changed a whole lot, that's for sure. Thank you for calling. Lila in Crawford County has something relating to foraging. Let's go there. Hi, Lila.
Hi. This time of year is prime season for harvesting watercress. And out here in the Driftless area, we have a lot of springs. And so most spring ponds have some watercress growing, and it's an excellent, healthful green this time of year. It's in its prime, and it's harvestable during any month with an R in the name.
Like oysters.
Lila, that's a good point. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call very much on that. Yeah.
I guess, watercress is very visible out in the Driftless area where you're driving along the road. Oh, look at how nice and green that is. But I guess the only thing to be concerned about, I guess, is the issue of private land or can you, because it's a public waterway, can you wade up the stream and collect? I don't know about that, but it's certainly out there as a resource. So
why not?
The listeners stepped up and gave us an example. That's great.
Thank you very much, Lila. Christy called but couldn't stay with us. She'd like you to talk about the snowshoe hares and the snowshoe hare population. This came up a few weeks back. Somebody wondered about that.
Well, among our various rabbits, snowshoe hares are pretty well known, pretty widely distributed across the country in northern reaches, and known in Wisconsin, mostly in about the northern half of the state, and particularly up in the North Woods, and then on up into Canada and up into the other Great Lakes states. So they're a reasonably common animal, but I think their claim to fame is the fact that their population behavior is very much cyclic. So yeah. They were the poster child for the early descriptions of what's called the 10-year cycle of wildlife abundance, where the hares tend to fluctuate greatly in numbers on a 10-year interval. So you've got a lot of hares, and then for 5 years they're kind of on the decline, then they're on the upswing, and then you've got a lot of hares again, and then they're gone. And that's a complicated interaction between the vegetation, their predators, and so forth. So there's a lot to say about that cycle. But that's where they got the most attention from a research and management standpoint. And I'm not real sure where they stand. They tend to fluctuate roughly with rough grouse numbers that are also cyclic and on that 10-year interval. But there's a little bit of a lag of a couple of years. Grouse are on the decline. So I'm assuming hares may be shortly if they're not already. Anyway, they're out there.
They're down in my area. Yeah.
Did you see many when you were hunting?
Not a single one. And I usually...
Did you see anything while you were hunting?
Some ravens.
Yeah. So the other difference between the snowshoes and cottontails, jackrabbits, are they turn white.
Yeah.
So they attract a lot of attention if they're caught in the interval, you know, it's a late snow season and they've turned white. Oh, they're very visible. But of course, that white pelage is a strategy for survival, and it works well for them. And I'm not sure what else she wanted to know.
She was really interested in the population, and you explained that, I think, very well. I think they're sort of on the downside. I did see one grouse, but saw no snowshoe hares. I usually see one at least, but not this year. You can join in, too. If you've got a story to tell or a question to ask about what's going on in the out-of-doors, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. You know, the Trump administration has proposed a change to the Endangered Species Act. I'm sure you're familiar with that. I'm wondering what your view is, or what would the changes eliminate if passed?
Not only are there changes in ESA, the Endangered Species Act, but more troubling, I think, from a wildlife or conservation standpoint, are some of the proposed changes or likelihood that there will be changes in how our vast public lands around the country, and particularly in the West, are held, maintained, and managed. So there are lots of things in the works at the federal level, including one we can talk about later on wolves. But as far as ESA, one of the changes proposed deals with a provision that allows species to be included or listed as kind of a group. Mm-hmm. And the proposed change will mean that any species, any animal, or whatever, that's proposed for listing as an endangered species would need its own individual review. And these can be very time-consuming and costly and so on. So the fear is that it will effectively limit how easily some of these animals find their way onto the endangered species list and enjoy the protections bestowed on them by listing.
Yeah.
But it's one of, whether it's weakening of the, and most people view that as a weakening of the Endangered Species Act. Others are concerned with EPA standards on assorted things. Park Service issues and a whole host of things. So we'll just have to see where it all plays out. But I guess as we've talked about a little bit on the program before, I think it behooves all of us here in Wisconsin, or no matter where you live in the country, we're all Americans and we all have a vested interest in public resources like wildlife, public lands, and so forth. So it pays to pay attention to what's going on and act accordingly, either as a with your representatives or as a voter or however you choose to do that. But it'll also lead into something we'll mention a little later, talking about Christmas and end of the year charitable giving and so forth, that there are a lot of groups, organizations, and activities that are strained right now as far as resources, and there are some ways to help. So we'll get to that a little later.
You know, that sudden snowfall, I guess we knew it was coming, but you didn't believe it, or I didn't think it was going to be that much. We got a foot of snow on my property, and I had not done much in the way of my bird feeding. And I didn't get them ready for winter like I should have. So what are you feeding these days, Scott, and what should people be doing regarding birds?
Well, I mean, I didn't do anything different like you. We were busy the day after Thanksgiving getting the family on the road home and a few other things, and then all of a sudden, oh, look, a snowflake, and then a lot of snowflakes, so everything was kind of on a standstill. The one thing I managed to get done that I knew was important was to get the stock tank heater in my water garden, my pond, so that there was continued air exchange with the fish and other life I have in the pond. And I did get that done. But I didn't do anything with the bird feeders. But it's other than keep them filled. And the birds are responding now. I mean, all their everything they were using, it was Fat City all fall. Lots of vegetative growth, lots of seeds. Now that's all under a big, thick layer of snow. And so the birds responded to the feeders very quickly and in large numbers. So I'm keeping them filled. But if people are worried, oh, gee, I meant to get it cleaned and sterilized and so forth, you know, it's not too late when the birds deplete the seed or just dump it in an empty bucket, take the feeders in and do what you'd normally do in terms of scrubbing them out and disinfecting them with a weak bleach solution and drying them out and putting them out, and they'll be fine for the winter. But it's a matter of servicing them on a regular basis, getting the seeds out there and keeping them clean, and the birds will take care of themselves. Like we talked about earlier, they will find a food source of some kind. They're pretty good at that.
Gus in De Pere has something, I believe, relating to birds. Let's go there. Hi, Gus.
Yeah, hi. They are a turkey population in the woods I hunt. I hunt near Bondwell, east of Green Bay, or west of Green Bay, east of Shawano. And 2 years ago, we had flocks all over. I had six toms running across the field to me. It was amazing. And now I'm not getting any on my game cams. We saw four hens this whole archery season. And I'm wondering, is bird flu having an effect on the native turkeys?
Interesting question.
An interesting question, but I've not heard anything about that, and the people who are involved in turkey management are not, that's doesn't seem to be a major concern right now, but the turkeys are kind of analogous to the deer situation right now. There are a lot of turkeys out there, just like there are a lot of deer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're conspicuous. Much like your observation, Gus, around my place where we have had in the past pretty good turkey hunting and we see turkeys in the spring, I haven't seen hide nor hair of a turkey for the last 2 months, and certainly not now that we have this snow cover. But they typically gather up and flock up in the winter into large flocks in some place where there's secure and there's good roosting trees and a food resource, like a picked cornfield or whatever, and they stay out of harm's way. So generally, the turkey population is doing pretty well after some concerns in recent years that turkeys had hit the glass ceiling. You know, we brought them back in in the 70s, and holy cow, the population went crazy. There seemed like there were turkeys all over the place, and then they began to retrench a little bit and stabilize, and I still think we have great turkey numbers, great turkey hunting opportunity in the state and opportunity to see them. They're just not very conspicuous this time of year. And human nature suggests, oh, if I don't see them, they must be gone. But that's not the case. And the same thing with the deer situation. You know they're out there. I see them on my son-in-law's trail camera pictures. They're big ones, and they're all over the place. And then, you know, you're trying to look for them and hunt them. They're nowhere to be found. But that's the nature of animals that have learned to live in a human footprint and take care of themselves.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's anything to be overly concerned about. And come more benign weather and the spring season, I think you'll see turkeys all over the landscape again.
Well, we saw some turkeys. A couple of my hunting partners saw some turkeys in, you know, Bayfield County. And this year, just before the season, the deer season, and it's amazing to me. I think there's probably turkeys in every county of the state now.
There are, and that was not expected, and it continues to amaze me. I'm headed up at the end of the week to my cabin in Price County to just make sure everything's okay for the winter, and I expect to see turkeys along the roadside probably more than I'm seeing them, you know, down here in Dane County, and they don't have the food resources that are available down here in ag land, but they're doing fine.
They're surviving. John in Eagle River, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. I feed the birds in the backyard. We don't have as much snow as you guys had down south. We only got about 4 inches, but I feed them. I used to feed them suet cakes, you know, the ones you buy at the hardware store.
Yeah.
And this year I, at a local butcher, I bought some real suet, you know, actual fat from stock. And they really seem to like that more. And I wondered if you could give me some advice. Which one's better? Is the stuff in the store actually just some kind of concoction? Or is this stuff that I'm buying directly from the butcher really better? I wonder if you could give me some feedback.
Well, the stuff you're getting from the butcher is pure. I mean, it's pure suet, unadulterated, no nothing. It's pure suet, and they will certainly take advantage of that, much the same as if you take the rib cage from a harvested deer and, you know, hang it up on the side of a tree, as I know some people do, and watch the birds pick away at that for a month or so until it's gone or cleaned. So suet in and of its own right is great, and you can actually render that yourself and make your own suet cakes if you're worried about additives or the wrong kind of seeds in the commercial cakes or whatever. You can make your own, and you can make it with rendered suet with stuff like cracked corn or sunflower hulls, things that are all 100% edible, as opposed to the commercial cakes which, say, have sunflower seeds in them, but you know, the bird's got to pull that sunflower seed out of the suet matrix and still shell it and eat the seed heart and discard the shell. You can make that a little easier for them if you want to bypass that step. But having said that, I use the commercial cakes for their convenience. I try and look for a reputable name brand and put them out, and the woodpeckers and nuthatches and assorted other things that like that suet just wipe them out. So I probably go through, 50, 60 cakes over the course of the winter. So they're utilizing them. If you did a side-by-side comparison and put out a chunk of suet from the butcher shop and a cake, you could do your own little experiment and see who prefers what. But they'll certainly use both. And pure natural suet is great, but it's not easy to get anymore. I've been looking around, for example, to some of my local grocery store meat counters and want to say, hey, I need some suet or some fat trimmings or whatnot, because I use it in grinding my venison and that kind of thing. And it's you're lucky you've got a butcher that's giving it to you, because the last stuff I found, they said, look, we use this to cut our burger mix and make sausages. So we have to charge, I think it was $4 a pound for fat. I think, whoa, times have changed. So if you've got a supply, by all means use it. And you're a lucky person, and your birds are lucky for that reason as well. But the commercial cakes will work fine.
John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Barry emailed us, why is Wisconsin considering a hunting season for sandhill cranes?
Why are they considering it? Well, because the crane population is strong, and when that happens, and when it deals with an animal, a mammal or bird, that is legal game in other states, then there's obviously, well, wait a minute now, they're hunting these cranes in the Dakotas or Nebraska or whatever. Well, we've got lots of cranes here in Wisconsin. Why can't we hunt them? So the move becomes some impetus from Wisconsin hunters or hunting interests to say, hey, these cranes could biologically sustain a harvest. Let's do it. And that comes up through the legislative process, the DNR, the spring Congress hearings, et cetera. And eventually a proposal is put forward. And then the decision is made on that. We have a little twist in Wisconsin because there was a Sandhill Crane Committee established to look into this whole matter of crane numbers, crane damage to agriculture, and so forth. And that committee, with a lot of valid stakeholders on it, as well as DNR people and so forth, their recommendation was to move forth a proposal to institute a sandhill crane hunt. And as far as I know, it hasn't been fully approved yet.
No.
And there is some pushback, of course, as you might expect. You rethink back to the pushback when mourning doves were declared a game species. I remember that well on the program. We were getting hate mail and threats and all sorts of things just talking about it. And there's some strong pushback on the cranes, too. Whether it will happen or not, I don't know. But the bottom line is that biologically, yes, we could harvest a limited number of cranes. If there is a season, it would be tightly controlled by permit applications and harvest controls, much the way we manage bears and other things that are handled by tag applications. So I'm not particularly worried about it being a threat to the crane population. And with the monitoring we do on cranes, even if it became one, close it down and end of story. But I don't foresee that happening. And I don't know where it's going to go as far as implementing the season. But the idea is simple. They're here. They could sustain some harvest. They're really good to eat. And they're very popular in areas that they are hunted. They're very wary, difficult to hunt birds. So
there you go.
There you go.
Scott Craven, our guest. I'm Larry Mealer. And you, my friends, are listening to WPR News. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mealer here taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Great to have Scott back. And callers online, but there's still a line open for you at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. Jonathan in Mount Horeb has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jonathan.
That's correct. Thank you. I have a farm in Mount Horeb, and over the years raised beef cattle. And 50 years ago, I planted over 20,000 trees, and they survived beautifully. A high percentage of them survived and grew into mature trees, with the exception of the several thousand of green ash I planted. The emerald ash borer got those. My last career job, I was executive secretary of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, and we manage the Common School Fund and have 88,000 acres of land up north, much of it timber. And our forester came to me one day and said, we've got a problem. The Northwoods natural regeneration is suffering from excessive deer predation. And he did a report for me, and it was rather startling. First of all, let me say I agree with you. This is not a uniform thing across the state. None of it is. There are some areas in the North Woods that are really low in deer, but there are also areas that are very, very high in deer population. And my area of Mount Horeb is such a thing. I cannot plant a tree anymore without protection, without losing it to deer predation. And it just never was that. The Forester's report posited that in 1970, approximately, there were 440,000 deer by the DNR census. And then in 2022, there were almost 2 million, 1.8 million. And I think they're concentrated in areas, and in those areas, it's almost impossible to grow a tree. without protection.
Yeah.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, deer effects on forestry, and not just on trees, but on understory plants and rare orchids and you name it, that's a major concern for any land manager, no matter where you are. I live just south of Madison, and there are a number of tree species that I could not possibly get to survive if I didn't have them fenced or caged or whatever. So that's certainly true. But when one of the management input schemes now are what are called Citizens Deer Advisory Committees, one for each county. I serve on the Dane County Committee, and there's always, every county, one of the interest groups that's supposed to be represented are forestry interests. So there's either a forester or someone with forestry and forest regeneration, forest management interests sits on that committee. And that input that they are responsible for gathering from their constituents within the county goes into the discussion process, with the CDAC then recommending to the DNR what the harvest level should be to control agricultural damage, deer vehicle collisions, forestry interests, all of the inputs that go in. So the system's in place to account for that, but that doesn't change the fact that, as you point out, there are certainly areas where there are way too many deer to allow the kind of regeneration or tree production that someone might want, whether it's, I think it was Gus growing his Christmas trees and having buck rubs on way too many of them, or people trying to get oak regeneration in their hardwood stands or whatever. The deer certainly are a factor in that, and they will be for a long time unless we can keep the numbers down where the DNR and the county CDACs want them. So, and yeah, that's not easy right now with the hunting pressure we have.
Yeah.
So.
Jonathan, thank you very much for calling. Karen in Green Lake County has something different to bring up, I believe. Karen, hi.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Scott. My question is about bats in the home. We've been kind of dealing with the saga of a bat in the house on Buffalo Lake in Montello for about a year now, and it's sort of become comical, but also not a little disconcerting. We're having work done on the house, so at this point, we haven't been able to complete.
Oh, we lost you.
There you are.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, we consulted a bat expert, and he's going to come and put the little bat, things that they put in so the bats can fly out but can't fly back in. But until we have the house, we're having siding put on and things like that. We've been just dealing with the occasional bat. We have a mosquito net right now around the bed, which has actually worked quite well. And when a bat is in the room, and we get it to fly out the window, one time we did have to dispose of a bat. But is there anything at this point, until we get the house completely finished, and that we can do to try to deter having to deal with a bat, especially in the bedroom?
Wow. Yeah, I can see where that would be a little disconcerting. But anyway, there are household bat problems are common, and they're typically dealt with, as you just suggested, by bat-proofing the house, which means sealing all of the little cracks and crevices, openings, loose soffit vents, whatever, so that the bat's access is denied. And that's done in conjunction with these little one-way devices called bat excluders that you described the person will employ. Those are only useful during the warm season when the bats are active and coming and going from the building. So there's not a great deal you can do right now as far as the bats and outside the house. But there certainly is, the other level is the living space separated from the common or structural space in the house. So the bats are likely living in the wall voids or in the attic, or maybe you know right where they are. But the bottom line is that there are spaces, gaps, crevices, or whatever, that are connecting your living space with where the bats are, just like there are spaces on the external surfaces of the house allowing the bats to come and go. Okay, so you can't do much about the outside, but you can certainly attack that bedroom. I'd start there, based on your description, and start looking around for where the heck are those bats coming from. And check light fixtures that may communicate with the attic or a wall void. Check if you've got old double-hung windows that have a sash weight in there. There's sometimes a gap in the window frame that communicates with the wall void. Look at heat vents. Look at structural damage, cracks, crevices. I mean, if there's a big hole in your drywall, start there. But look around meticulously.
They can fit through a hole the size of a dime.
Or smaller. And if it's a crack, you know, just literally a quarter or three-eighths of an inch is plenty of room. So you have to look for everything that could conceivably communicate with the space the bats are currently living in or hibernating in, and seal it up. You can do that with a caulking gun. You can do it with a handful of steel wool and a screwdriver. You can do it with Gorilla tape. You can use whatever material you want, depending on the look you're striving for, but seal up that bedroom so that you can... You don't have to be sleeping under mosquito netting. That seems a little extreme this time of year. So, you know, I don't know how big or how complex the architecture is. If there are lots of gables or corners or whatever, it may be a little more complicated. But if it's basically a square, drywalled room, there's only a limited number of points.
I'd start with the lights.
Yeah, start with the lights and go down the seams or... Anything you can think of, any tiny crack. Don't overlook anything by saying, oh, that's too small. No, it isn't. Don't leave anything left that would provide them with access, and you should be able to sleep soundly. So good luck.
Good luck, Aaron. Oh, my goodness, mosquito netting. Oh, boy, this time of the year. Oh, well, on to other things. Carrie and Nina, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Larry and Scott. So I live in beautiful Neenah, and we love walking in the summer. And we are getting continually attacked by the red-winged blackbird. And I have heard that they are on the protected species list. And I was wondering if Scott Craven could use his influence and maybe get them off the protected list. I don't even know what that means. But we are truly being brutally attacked by I believe it's the fathers of the babies in the nest during the nesting time. And it makes it so people have to walk around with umbrellas. They don't want to go for a walk at all. And we live in a gorgeous area. Sometimes they give birth lay eggs twice, I think. And so it's a kind of a protracted season.
Well, first of all, the status of different birds, you mentioned protected list. All migratory birds have some level of protection. But blackbirds are a special case because they're a major agricultural problem. So, again, I'm a little out of the loop from retirement, but I think it's still a situation where although blackbirds are protected, there was a clause. It was my favorite clause in the wildlife regulations. Blackbirds are protected unless they're concentrated so as to constitute a nuisance or are causing damage. So when I was talking to, you know, agricultural interests, I always said, well, you know, if you're on the farm and there's a blackbird sitting on the speed limit sign out on the highway, boy, that sucker's about to do damage. And all of a sudden, you were then freed to take action against blackbirds. And if we're running out of time here, we can pick this up, Larry. That's up to you. But bottom line is, I'm wondering if they weren't on the protected list, what would you do differently? I mean, would you carry a shotgun on your walk?
No.
I mean, there's really not much you can do. It's a seasonal thing when they're nesting. It is the males. And, you know, armed with a hat and a little awareness that they're going to maybe whack the back of your head, you know, they're just doing their thing. I guess no harm, no foul.
I got the back of my head knocked a couple of times this spring by a male red wing. Well, Scott Craven is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Scott. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening. Scott and I are joking about things here on the show, off the air. And nothing that relates to the business at hand, which is to talk about the world of wildlife. And we're going to do that right now, right up until 12:30 with Scott. And Brett in Dane County has a solution to the blackbird problem, I think, that came up just before our break. Brett, what's on your mind?
Yes, Larry, happy holidays, and we appreciate all your great service and shows.
Thank you.
Well, coming from Oklahoma, I've only listened to you, I think, for 37 years. So, you know, it's like
you're a newcomer.
I am a newcomer. I did study wildlife biology at Colorado State, Scott. So I have, you know, hey. I tried to learn a little bit about wildlife. But, of course, as a freshman, I mostly focused on wildlife management, which was, you know.
Understood.
But what I like to do when I'm out hiking is wear a stiff broad-brim hat. And I don't wear my best Sunday go-to-meeting cowboy hat. I have a ratty one so that they don't really – that way they don't, you know, ruin my good resistol. But and then I found in biking, especially out of Pheasant Branch Creek and the other marshes during their mating season, you bike helmet works pretty good. You know, they – they bounce right off the top of that.
So. There you go. Wear a hat. Wear a cowboy hat, an old one, so they don't get beat up. And then when you're biking, you ought to be wearing a helmet anyway, and that's a good protection.
There
so
you
that's
go.
Brett's solution to the blackbird problem. Brett, thanks for calling. Oh, boy. Marsha, in Racine, we'll go to you now.
I have just heard Brett's solution for red-winged blackbird, but I have a somewhat different and low-tech one. I walk the bike trail every day up behind the zoo in Racine, and blackbirds tend to nest along there. And basically all I do is clap my hands over my head, and they stay away.
So you clap your hands over your head.
Yep, that's it.
That's a good look. I suppose it'll work, but
and you, for double protection, you could wear a cowboy hat and clap your hands over your head.
Well, I guess I wonder.
I can't picture you doing that, but actually, Marcia says it works for her.
I mean, it would if that motion. I was trying to think of something where you could have a hat with a little flexible piece of tubing on it or something with something dangling there that would scare them. But I think people just need to be a little creative, but use some common sense and protect yourself, because it's going to happen. And the birds are, you know where it's going to happen because it's happened before and it'll happen again. And let the birds go about their business for a few weeks and everybody gets on with their life.
Yeah, it gets your attention when one knocks the back of your head, that's for sure. Marcia, thank you for calling. Michael in Wauwatosa, let's go to you now. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment on the changing nature of the deer season and the introduction or the introduction of wolves into my area where I hunted. I've been hunting in north central Wisconsin and northwestern Shawano County since the 70s. And back in the day, on opening weekend, you could hear drives all over, and you know, it was kind of enriching, and it's really quieted down over the years. My area has such a high deer population that there's absolutely no reproduction of hardwoods. Every hardwood tree that I have, I have to put wire around it, and I paid a lot of money at a Fleet Farm for these 6-foot rolls of wire that I string out. Cut the bottom rung off, and then I make cages around every tree. So when the wolves moved into the area, say about 12, 15 years ago, I was overjoyed. And I'm an avid deer hunter, but I was thrilled to hear to know that the wolves moved in. I've seen them on wildlife cameras, and I actually had the joy of hearing them howl last February when I was working outside at night. The point that as the hunting population or the hunters have decreased, it's good to know that the wolves have increased.
Well, so there's another view.
Something has to pick up the slack, and certainly wolves are changing deer distribution and in some places numbers, but there's a lot of opinions on whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. But in Michael's case, it seems to be a good thing. So.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Barry in Oslo, we'll go to you. Hi, Barry.
Well, Larry, I want to first of all thank you because I drive regularly from the Chicago area back up to my home county of Douglas County to visit my 108-year-old mother.
Oh, my goodness.
And you are my company to and from. growing up in Douglas County, some of the folks that had some land would put out a salt block for the deer. Now, I don't mean for hunting, of course. I mean just because they wanted to attract deer to the land. And I'm wondering, is that good for the deer, bad for the deer? Is that a good idea? And what can you put out to, you know, have some deer around when you don't see them so much anymore?
Well, putting out a mineral block or salt block, as it once was, and just salt water. I remember we drained the hot water heater one day out at the farm, and the deer excavated a hole in the lawn where that had drained out because of the salt. So they crave the salt, and they're also in the mineral blocks, a variety of trace minerals that the deer need, like all the minerals and supplements, you know, we take as humans. So it can be attractive, but right now you run into the conflict in most counties with the CWD regulations, or at least requests, that you not do things that concentrate deer to minimize the spread of chronic wasting disease. And I think it's 59 counties now that are affected by CWD or by the feeding and baiting bans, and I think that applies to the mineral blocks as well.
It does.
So you're kind of... While it may seem like a good idea, Barry, and in better times or olden days or in the future when CWD hopefully magically disappears or retrenches, maybe we'll be doing it again. But at least for now, it's not as easy to do as it once was.
Yeah. Caught between a salt block and a hard place.
Yeah, that's a good one, Larry.
There we go.
Working on some new material.
And by the way, on CWD, Mark had emailed wondering, is there a home CWD test kit?
No.
No,
and
unfortunately.
And I would like to be the person who develops it because I'd be...
Wealthy.
I'd be wealthy, but there are a lot of people working on quicker tests, field tests, home tests, whatever you want to call it, but so far there's nothing practical available.
I wish there was. And... thinking about deer and thinking about turkeys we've been talking about reminds me about permits.
Yeah, there's another deadline coming up next week. December 10th is the deadline for spring turkey applications, and there are lots of people who apply for those. Some already have, depending on what they've purchased for licenses, but the deadline for getting into the first round of drawing for the turkey permits for next April and May's turkey hunting is next week, and that's also Bear Point deadline. And anyway, if you've got a license, if you're looking at activities for next year, make sure you don't miss any DNR deadlines. And their website is really pretty good about keeping people informed on that now. But don't let a deadline slip by.
Yeah, the patron license. I have a patron's. I believe it's called a patron's license,
mm-hmm.
And for that, I was able to select those dates when I bought the license for this year. And some people do that, and some people would prefer not to do it that way.
You can do it as quickly as you know that you're interested in a particular zone and time period. Once you know that, there's no point in waiting.
Yeah, no point in waiting. Let's see. Bill in Oregon emailed us. And Bill has driven to the Oregon Correctional Facility on Highway M for many years. This summer, he saw them dismantling the pheasant rearing pens. And have pheasant policies changed, or did they just move the rearing to a different location?
Neither, and I need to clarify what happened too, because I live very close to the Oak Hill facility, and I used to enjoy going by and say, "Oh, the pheasants are here! I can hardly wait until they're put down at the wildlife area." That was just basically a holding facility. The birds are still raised at Poinette at the state game farm, and they simply shipped birds to Oak Hill where they were held prior to stocking around here in a very populated area where a lot of birds were put out. I'm assuming, I don't know what the reason was for the dismantling of the Oak Hill pens, but as far as I know, for local use, for stocking on our wildlife areas here in Dane County, the surrounding area, they just got their birds directly from Poinette. Whether that will persist for the future, I don't know, but I'll find out as soon as our upcoming CDAC meeting with our county wildlife manager. But I've asked around a lot, and nobody knew, so I don't know.
Something to report on the next time you're on.
Yep.
For sure, to talk about that. And actually, I could mention that you'll be on a few more times, and then things are changing for you, too.
Yes, I was, as you know, I mean, you've been a friend for a long time, and we started with radio work back with those old Ag Facts tapes in your office back in the early 80s, and it's been a long run ever since. But with your announcement on Monday that you'll be stepping down in June, as I've told you personally for many years, when you go, I go. So the bottom line is the June program that I'm scheduled for, at least for now, which I think is June 3rd, that'll be the last one I do as well. So,
we'll have some fun that day.
We'll have some fun that day, but it's been a long run, and it's been a great and very productive run, and I'm in many ways sorry to see it come to an end, but it's increasingly difficult to stay in the loop. The questions become, you know, you want to give people up-to-date factual information, and it's when you're not in the office every day and all, it's not, it gets complicated doing that. So I think it makes sense for me, and I've got other things to do. And so June will be the end for both of us.
Well, but we're still not at the end of the show, so let's talk about gifts, because one of the things I was on my mind was gifts for the outdoors person or the conservation-minded person.
Well, the holidays are coming up, and there are a lot of elements of this here. We're talking about charitable donations, and of course with Giving Tuesday and a variety of other things, there are all sorts of ways that people can help further the mission of conservation through donations, and those can be made in someone else's name by way of a recognition or gift, or perhaps a family member, avid hunter or whatever, who's passed. And, you know, there are many of them, but the ones that come to mind locally include the Natural Resources Foundation, Greenfire, the Conservation Hall of Fame, the Cherish Fund that the DNR and the Natural Resources Foundation maintain. And at the federal level, there are a couple of groups that support national parks. You know, figure out where your interests lie and then support these groups. And, of course, there are many non-governmental organizations that you can support with a simple membership. So buying someone a membership as a gift, whether it's Audubon or National Wildlife Federation or any of the species-specific groups, Rocky Mountain Elk, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, there are many of them, and I don't mean to omit anyone, but I can't give the exhaustive list. But there are many organizations like that where someone gets a membership and all of a sudden they're invited to the banquet, they get the publication and other mailings, they're in with a group of like-minded friends, and it's a good thing. On the gift front, there's so much gadgetry and technology involved in all outdoor activities now that it's almost impossible to keep a handle on it. But in terms of outdoor gear, you know, clothing, optics, good quality footwear. There's any number of things you can get for the outdoors-minded person. Hunting and fishing gear from a $2 packet of jigs for a walleye fisherman to a really nice rod and reel or even a firearm. It's the limit of what you're thinking about. Specifically, there are a couple of things that I find particularly useful. One of them is the Onyx app on my phone. if somebody's not familiar with that. And it doesn't have to be for a hunter. It's used as a hunting app, but the point is it's like a geolocating app. With Onyx, you know exactly where you are on the landscape, no matter where you are, with your little blue dot. And then there are all sorts of data overlays. So when I was in New Mexico a couple of weeks ago hunting elk in the middle of nowhere on the edge of the Gila Wilderness on a very nice ranch with a wonderful ranch family, you know, I could look and say, oh, well, there I am, and the ranch house is over there or whatever. You can get ownership patterns. You can get regulations.
Property lines.
It avoids the problems of inadvertent trespassing. That's a great possible gift. And
what's the app again?
Onyx.
Onyx.
Onyx. And there are other apps like that that can be very useful. So on the technology front, there are all sorts of things in that regard. You've got a game cooking person coming up here in a few minutes on the show. You still have the opportunity to utilize what you've harvested for gifting. And, you know, in my case, coming back with half an elk, my son got the other half. Now all of a sudden I'm the beneficiary of a lot of packages of elk steak, and everybody that I know of who's now, I'd love to try some elk. So all of a sudden, you know, you have gift giving with what you've harvested. Or in a general sense, there's still plenty of deer seasons coming up. If you're out there and you don't want another deer, well, there's the sharing that with people with food insecurity. There are ways to donate the deer, put on a game dinner, all sorts of things. And you'll probably talk about that in the next issue. I find particularly useful with my appearances on this program, much like the Onyx app, a subscription to Outdoor News. You know, there's all sorts of useful columns in there. And you had Pat Durkin on, I think. He always has a very informative column in Outdoor News on what's going on with the deer situation or whatever. And those kinds of things can be very helpful. And it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving. Bird feeding, we talked about a little earlier. There are all kinds of gifts related to bird feeding, from the feeders themselves down to seed storage, the seed itself, and all sorts of other things at the stores, both the brick-and-mortar stores that deal with bird feeding supplies as well, or one of your sponsors, actually, I think. So and even particularly for folks who are shut in or their mobility is impaired, but they like to feed the birds, they can't handle a 40-pound bag of black oil sunflower seeds. But, hey, a couple bags dropped off at the house and put in a storage container, another great gift to keep people involved in the activities that they like. And I guess the other thing I had on the list were everybody seems to be into trail cameras now or motion detector cameras, but they've become very sophisticated. They've gone down in price, much like TVs did over the years. But if you don't have a camera on your property or even in your backyard, it's a terrific way to see what's going on out there. And you'll see the animals that you just, I don't think there's a fox around, but, oh, there he is. And the ones now with cellular capability, so that, you're sitting having dinner and all of a sudden, beep, what's that? And you see that, there's a bear out in front of my camera or whatever, allows you to see some of those things you wouldn't otherwise. So anyway, there's just a few ideas, but the outdoor literature is replete with detailed ideas of new books and gadgetry and assorted other things, and the sky's the limit.
I haven't done any, thinking about trail cameras, I haven't done any pricing lately on them. What do they run anyway anymore?
It depends on the line. I mean, you can get, budget packs, even twin packs of cameras for under $100. But you can spend for the kinds that are used for research or are issued to people, for example, for the Snapshot Wisconsin program. Some of those are hundreds of dollars. But like anything else with technology, you get what you pay for. But even some of the I use relatively inexpensive cameras around the house, and they work fine. And I put my cameras out back in September with normal AA Duracell batteries or whatever they are, and they're still working just fine. And I get hundreds and hundreds of pictures, and it's fun to bring in bring in the data card and put it on the computer and say, oh, let's see what's going on here. And it's a fun thing to do, and makes a good gift, too. So,
Mary emailed us. She has a suet suggestion. She's been using a product called Peckinlogs, P-E-C-K-N-L-O-G-S, Peckinlogs, for years, and these can be found in the larger grocery stores like Woodman's and Hanson's IGA and that sort of thing, and they're found in the freezer section, usually near where various meats are displayed. And she loves that suet, but she says, make sure you securely cage them to protect raccoons and other critters from carrying them off, because they will. That last part was all in capital letters.
There's always a downside, but I remember one of our listeners who's now passed visiting him up in Price County, and all he fed was margarine sticks. And he had little wire feeders that a quarter-pound stick of margarine would slide into, and he had those around the windows. And holy cow, I remember the gray jays and assorted other northern birds just went nuts over that frozen margarine. And so...
They were getting something out of it.
So,
cheaper than putting butter out, I guess, in that situation.
Well, that's the thing. So... there are lots of possibilities. Be creative, but get out there and enjoy the wildlife resources we have. There are lots of things you can do with them that make them better off, but also enrich your life. And in the meantime, happy holidays to everybody. This will be the last pre-Christmas show that I'll be on, and you too, for that matter. But
we'll have some fun.
We'll
have some fun in February when you come back.
Yes, I'll be back. I'll probably fit a little time in a warmer climate in between now and then, but we'll see how that goes, and I'll hopefully have something to report on.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, and we'll look forward to your visit in February, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, February.
February.
February, April, and June. Those are the next three.
Those are the next three, yes.
Okay, Scott Craven. We'll be back in February, and we will do this all over again with him. Big thanks to him, and thank you for listening. And stay with us now, because we're going to turn our attention to cooking the wild game, that the deer or maybe the pheasants or the ducks that are still maybe in the freezer, and other game as well, with our next guest, Chef Joel Olson. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. So, have you considered adding wild game to your holiday menus this year? You don't have to be intimidated. Up next, we're talking with a chef who specializes in preparing wild game. He can prepare almost anything. Chef Joel Olson back with us. He's nationally recognized culinary instructor. He's based in Madison, has almost 30 years of experience teaching culinary skills to children, to youth and adults, and it's always fun to have him come by. And let's talk about wild game with him for a while here. Did you get a deer this year, or do you have access to some venison or maybe some other wild game? What questions do you have about preparing venison? Let's zero in on that a little bit, too. Let us know maybe your favorite way to prepare or eat wild game. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Chef Joe, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Happy New Year from last year. I didn't see you since last year. So
it's been a long time.
I know. Sorry about that. But yeah, it's nice to hear your voice.
And you're a hunter. How'd it go for you this year?
I had a good year. I tried to the week before oh, the week before deer season, I used to head up towards the Mead, central Wisconsin, and there was still a bunch of ducks. It reminded me of the old days when the big flocks would take off out of the refuge. It sounded like a small jet with all the wings flapping, and it got to hear that, and some trumpeter swans, I saw them, and had shots at some geese, and it was just a wonderful experience. And then we had that big, heavy snow that just kind of shut everything down up there about noon. and then headed down to Vernon County and ended up getting a deer in opening day. So I had a wonderful week.
How did you first start trying out recipes for wild game? Was it a long time back, I imagine?
I found a menu from my very first game feed that I, because I do that the dinner every year for my friends and family. 1999 was the first year I did the game feed, and I just happened to have an abundance of stuff and some friends I knew that hunted, and I just started it then. I found my very first menus tucked in a book over at my house in Viroqua. And it's like kind of, there's the date right there.
I'm looking at the 2025 game feed menu, which involves pheasant, venison in various assorted ways, rabbit and cabbage. You've got a fried panfish. You've got, oh my gosh, turkey. Oh my goodness. There are a lot of dishes. And I've done a few of those wild game feeds too. And you wind up with a lot of dishes, but it's really always a lot of fun for people.
Oh, it's like my culinary Super Bowl. I go all out and just really, I challenge myself, and it's all for fun. It's not for money, so that makes it even better. So makes it even more challenging.
TJ, precious indeed. TJ in Monona has something for us. Question, I believe. Hi, TJ.
Hi, you guys. My question involves city squirrels versus country squirrels. I guess what I mean is that we have a fountain in the three seasons, you know, spring, summer, fall. And then in the winter, we put a heated water bath out there. And the squirrels and the birds and probably raccoons and God knows what else all use that. Now my question has to do with am I endangering not only the squirrel or the raccoon, but also my ability to eat the squirrel and the raccoon. So any comments on that? And I'll take them off the air. Thank you.
All right. So can you eat neighborhood squirrels?
If you can get away with it, I suppose. You know, if the neighbors don't miss the squirrels, I don't know. Because I don't know I don't think you can actually hunt them. I think in the city or trap them and kill them in the city. I don't know the laws on that one, but I'm thinking rabbits are the only thing a landowner can actually, you know, deal with as far as, if I'm not mistaken, but that's kind of out of my purview. I know how to cook stuff, but I don't know quite the laws when it comes to, you know, harvesting things in the city.
Yeah. But the meat itself, if you were legal to do it, if from a city squirrel, is probably not a whole lot different from a one.
It might even be better because they're getting a variety of food where you'll have just acorns. You know, like say, you know, you go to a classic oak forest and all they're eating basically is acorns. So it's going to have a pronounced, you know, kind of a nutty taste. They'll have a more rounded taste because they have a variety of foods. So that's my answer to that.
Yeah. What's the, what are common mistakes? And I ask you this pretty much every time you are on, but what common mistakes do people make when they're preparing wild game?
Overcooking it, I think, would be the number one thing, is just tending to overcook it, especially the leaner cuts of meat. It's kind of like when people say they don't like lamb because it's always been overdone and kind of gamey. Same thing happens with wild game. You cook it too long. Some of it you have to cook long. There's cuts of meat like the shanks and things like that where you're doing it till it kind of pulls off the bone. But, you know, when you have a nice roast or something like that, you want to cook it so that it's just done, so that when you slice it, the moisture is still in the meat, because there is no fat in the meat itself. There's no marbling in wild game. It's all the fat's all on the outside of the muscle. So, you know, and you want to clean most of that fat off. I haven't run across much wild game fat that I find enjoyable. Like you might like a little pork fat or make like a little fat with your beef, but wild game fat tends to be kind of not tasty at all. So you're cooking pure protein, so you got to keep that in mind.
Yeah, and you mentioned adding things. Tom emailed us, and he says you should try grinding venison with bacon ends that you can get at about $1.50 a pound. and that makes a delicious burger.
Oh, absolutely. Bacon burgers are wonderful. No, that's a great idea. Instead of just pork as well. But then you've got it does taste like bacon. So if you're willing for it to taste like that, that's a nice option to have in your repertoire of burgers. That's for sure.
Dan in Sauk City has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Larry. First, I want to say I'm going to be counting the days till June 30th. It's off my daughter's birthday. I've been listening to you for close to 40 years, 37 years. You're going to be well missed.
Oh, thank you.
And, in fact, you were my ex-wife. You were one of her professors at one time. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So my question is, a friend of mine gave me some pheasant. It's frozen in a Ziploc baggie or a seal-type bag, and I've never cooked pheasant before. What is the best recommendation?
I like to brine. I think we always talk about brining, too. My recipe for brine is a third cup of table salt, a third cup of granulated sugar, and then 2 quarts of water. That's just my basic brine for anything. You can change the liquid. You can change flavor. You can add flavorings to it. But I would brine it for like thaw it, and then put in the brine for maybe 4 or 5 hours and take it out. And then one of the best ones I've ever done is I cooked it in just a little bit of butter and cream, just kind of like simmered in buttered and cream. And oh, my gosh. It was just wonderful with egg noodles, and you could add some leeks or some onions to that if you wanted to make a little bit more depth of flavor, but it was just so delicious. So cut it up after you brined it, and then just cook it gently, and don't season after you brine stuff with this one anyway. Don't season it with salt. It's got plenty in there.
So what's the brine? Do the brine once more, because people will say, wait a minute, I didn't get that.
It's 1/3 cup sugar, granulated sugar, 1/3 cup table salt, and then 2 quarts of water.
2 quarts of water.
Yep.
Okay. Did you get that, Dan?
I did, and I thank you so very much. And you've always been a joy to listen to, Larry.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it very much. I appreciate your call, too. Because that brine is something that will probably turn up again here on the show. Amy in Oxford, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, I just wanted to let you know that our number one venison family favorite is paprika venison over parsley buttered noodles. I have my grandkids from as early as they can eat, they just love this, absolutely love it. It's very tender, and you bake it for a few hours, and it's just one of our family favorites. But if I want to get fancy, though, I do a venison loin in the brandy and mushroom sauce that I flame. And I serve that over wild rice and a vegetable too. But there's one thing I have a hard time cooking is goose breasts. He said, oh, that's nothing, I'll cook it. So he took it and he cooked it for 3 days in a slow cooker, and it still was leathery. So that's one thing I can't cook. So if there's anything, you know, ideas, let me know. So
goose breast.
The story that goes with the brine with last year's game feed, I was given a bunch of Canada goose breasts and a few snow goose breasts. And I brined them for 2 days in that same brine. I left them in there. And this friend, one of the friends that gave me the Canada goose, he goes, what the heck did you do with my goose? And I thought, what do you mean? He goes, it's delicious. it tasted like tenderloin. It had the same texture and not gamey, and it had like beef tenderloin. It was just amazing. So, and you could see what had come out of the goose breast. It was just, you know, it had totally changed the texture. I mean, it wasn't mushy or anything, but it just really pulled a lot of gaminess out of that. And it was just absolutely delicious. It did taste like beef tenderloin. So, you know, for fowl, no, 12 hours, maybe overnight at the most. But for the really, you know, like Canada goose breast, I say 2 days. It's just wonderful.
And again, that is 1/3 cup of table salt, 1/3 cup of sugar, and 2 quarts of water, Amy, and 2 days.
Yep, 2 days.
You got that?
I got that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can call in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking about cooking wild game today with Chef Joel Olson of Hema Chef, nationally recognized culinary instructor and based in Madison, and a good guy, too. Questions for him, you can join in 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Teddy in Barnes, Wisconsin. Teddy, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
We're up here still plowing snow. So, goose breast. What I learned from my grandma, Grandma Barnes, was take the breast, put it in a bowl with milk in it, sit overnight in the fridge. Then we take it out, we cut it into strips, and we would batter it and fry it. It's like chicken tenders. It's just unbelievable.
It sounds good to me. What do you think, Chef Joel?
Yeah, milk is a wonderful marinator, wonderful way to tenderize. I do that with my elk and venison liver. I soak it in milk. The lactic acid kind of helps break things down and pulls out some of the impurities, and that's a great and frying it. You fry anything. I'm for it.
it's gonna work. Yeah, I remember way back, Cy Littleby's Guide to Cooking Wild Game. Cy reported that if you put the goose in cold water, salted water, and then you bring the water up to just to the point of boiling, and then you take it out, and you will be amazed at the about inch and a half of something on the top of the water that has been taken out of the goose.
Sure.
That is, then go ahead and cook it however you want to, and you're going to turn out all right.
That's a great, because you think about if you ever boil chicken or make soup or something, you get that same foam on top, even from chicken. So, that's a great idea. Get rid of some of those impurities and the different, that's a great idea as well.
So we heard about a fancier recipe from a caller earlier. What about a fancier recipe for hosting a holiday party? What do you recommend?
Oh, I try to stick with just for game feed, of course, that's different. But if I'm doing what I recommend for my classes and stuff is to stay within your comfort level in terms of, like, don't try out something on your guests unless you are really, a good cook and you know that it's going to work. Mm-hmm. Just so that there's nothing more embarrassing. I hope you like this. It's the first time I've tried it. I really, I never want to say that when I'm when I'm hosting something. But I love that paprikash, the paprika venison that she was talking about. Something like long and simmered and just some. I can imagine that with mashed potatoes would be wonderful, nice and buttery and creamy mashed potatoes, and something that's been cooked for a long time and just can kind of scoop and pour, as opposed to trying to fillet do a roulade where you're taking a little part of a roast or whatever and filleting it open and stuffing it and wrapping it up and tying it. And that's a totally different ballgame when it comes to cooking. So I sometimes the most elegant things are sometimes the most simple things.
Yeah.
And people really appreciate it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about for a minute before we get back to the recipes. I was online looking at your website, and you offer a lot of classes.
Yeah, I do. It's the busiest I've ever been, and ironically, this is my 30th season of teaching cooking. I've actually reached 30 now. 30 years I've been teaching cooking, so and still love it. Still love sharing my knowledge and the love of food. And tonight I have a parent and child dumpling class that I'm teaching, international dumplings. And so I do something different every day. So I'm really lucky to have found something that I really enjoy and that people tend to want to enjoy with me.
Yeah, it sounds. And you work with the broadest age range. I mean, you like to work with children, I notice.
Yeah, I do a lot of kids' classes. Our website, hemachef.com. We've got summer camps coming up. That's usually my busiest time where other people are off. That's when I'm working. It's just been a wonderful. I've had some kids through the years that have actually gone off to culinary school, and had one kid that was in my summer camp out in Virginia that actually went to Top Chef Junior, was on TV, and it's been really, really been fun. So, yeah, all of our, and I have, I also have the recipe for the brine on our website as well for anybody who didn't get it. We've mentioned it a couple times. So.
How do you get, or how can we get children involved in cooking wild game? I mean, what is there any magic to that?
That's a great question, because I don't do too much of that, only because a lot of people don't have the
game.
But I think it goes to the number one thing: getting kids to try it. And if they've had a chance to make it, they have a better chance of trying it as opposed to here, try this. And then what I always did with my daughter, who just loves food, and she's a great cook now, she's a sophomore in college, and I always made her explain to me, why don't you like something? You know, like, if you don't like it, why? You know, and just give me some kind of a reason why, so that we can work on it, or I can understand, instead of just, no, I don't like that. So I think just, you know, and not cajoling, not hiding it, that I've never hidden food inside of food, just like trying to get, you know, like pureed, you know, stuff so that kids would know what they're eating. I think they should know what they're eating. But I think it's just having being exposed to it and the joy of somebody else enjoying it. Sometimes they see people loving something. They're like, hey, maybe I will try that. So experience, I guess, is the number one thing.
You mentioned rabbit earlier, and John's wondering, what are the best ways, different ways to prepare rabbit?
Oh, my dad, when he was alive up in Marshall at the Elks Club, they used to do a rabbit feed where they do a curry. They dredge it and just nice little curry, and then cook it and roast in the oven, roast it, and all falling off the bone. It was amazing. So I like that. I like slow cooking it and pulling it off the bone. And one of my favorite things to do, and it's called it's not too fancy. It had a fancy name. It's called a rillette, which is where you take the rabbit meat and some cream cheese, and you paddle it in a mixer so that it becomes like a paste. You're adding seasonings in there too, maybe some thyme and a little bit of brandy if you want, and some onion powder and garlic powder, and it turns into a wonderful cracker spread. It's called a rillette. It's wonderful. So that's kind of a fun thing to do.
Cook rabbit, by the way.
Yep, cooked rabbit. Yep,
rabbit's cooked first.
Yep.
And what about squirrel, as long as we're at it?
Oh, it's the squirrel. It's the number one thing that people, one of the number one things at Game Feed they look for is they want the squirrel pizza. So I cook it until a friend of mine, Steve Owen from Sun Prairie, he's been giving me canned squirrel. He canned squirrels that he gets. So we just go through the squirrel you cook it in canned meat, basically. We go through it like four times and so make sure there's no little bones, because they have tiny little bones. It's kind of a bummer to bite into something. There's a bone in it. And then I make a pizza out of it. Use it as a pizza topping. It's just absolutely delicious.
And you had fish on your menu, and I know there are people who have some frozen fish in the freezer yet from last summer.
You bet.
What about preparing fish?
What I've done with some of my bluegills, you know, especially when they're fillets, maybe you're tired of having, you know, fried fish. I'd go through it again with a fine tooth, you know, fingers, feeling for any of those little bones that you might have missed. Makes a wonderful chowder, like a potato and fish chowder or bluegill chowder. It's absolutely delicious. Some corn in it. And I put I make it so the soup is totally done, and then I put the fillets, these nice little bite-sized fillets in it right at the very end so that they don't fall apart and turn into just like mush. So you have some texture. So it's a wonderful way to use up some of the those fillets. And also I like fish loaf, too. I remember my Aunt Bessie here many years ago in Madison visiting her and my Uncle John, and she would make salmon loaf, which is like a Betty Crocker type of recipe with breadcrumbs and a white sauce and eggs. And I've done that with fillets as well, walleye, and I did a northern pike salmon loaf a few years ago, and this year I did salmon and cod, a cod that somebody had brought me from Alaska. They were up fishing in Alaska and brought back some cod. So it's a couple ideas right there anyway.
Yeah, those are good ones. Here's a crazy one. What are some of the craziest meats, wild meats that you've tried?
Well, last year, my friend Steve asked me if I wanted a possum, and I'm like, sure, because I always wondered what possum tasted like, but I really didn't want to hunt one and deal with cleaning it, and he was more than happy to do it, and it's delicious. I braised it, you know, cooked it in liquid. I cooked, you know, boiled it basically and let it simmer till it was falling off the bone, I made a gumbo out of it, and I had some little tiny octopus, made it really even stranger. I had a gumbo and octopus gumbo. I mean, a possum and octopus gumbo, and for some reason, I had quite a bit of it left over. I don't know why, but...
Well, if you and you always tell people what they're eating, so that may have,
absolutely
that may have turned some people off from trying the gumbo.
Absolutely, I did. I tell them back in the day when I used to do this game feed in Viroqua, and I was totally living in Viroqua. I didn't have all the lightings that I have now, and so it was dark, and people said, it's good, but I wish I knew what I was eating. It was always the biggest complaint, if they're eating in the dark and couldn't see what they were eating. So maybe it was better back then that way. I don't know. So.
Can you, what do you think, or maybe you can you talk about chronic wasting disease and foodborne illnesses associated with wild game cooking?
Yeah, the chronic wasting disease, I know that's a tough one to deal with, only because of, you know, everybody's so worried, and they should be, because we don't know what that harm could be to humans. But essentially, when it comes to foodborne illness, waterfowl, pheasants, they carry, especially pheasants, carry a lot of salmonella. They have it. I mean, it's a lot of them have it. So you really want to make sure that you've cooked it totally through. You don't want any pink. You want it totally, you know, pulling off the bone, totally well done. So you totally destroy it, any chance of having any kind of foodborne illness. Venison, I push it a little bit. Of course, the tenderloin is wonderful. I do a tartare, which is basically raw with some, maybe a little bourbon and some bitters, you know, sprinkled on top for an old fashioned, you know, it's carpaccio, that type of thing. But normally I cook things pretty much all the way through. Pushy birds and squirrels and rabbits. And yeah, raccoon last year we had as well, which is absolutely insanely good. It's delicious. Just sweet, wonderful meat. So I'm looking forward to hopefully having raccoon again next year.
Yeah. You want to stay away from the fat though.
Absolutely. Again, I cook it in a pot until it's tender, pull it out, pull it off the bone. And then I used it to make a sandwich. My, Dad used to make a big beef sandwich with like French bread and sliced beef and cheddar cheese, and then wrap it up and put it in the oven and let the cheese melt. And I did that similar thing with my raccoon and some wonderful cheese from probably from Hooks, I think. So, yeah, it was fun.
Sally emailed, her boyfriend brought back some antelope meat to Thanksgiving this year, and she was too nervous to try it. Did she miss out?
She sure could have. She sure could have missed out. I was thinking today that I wish I had. I used to have an antelope person. There's a person whose father-in-law went antelope hunting out west, and I haven't. He hasn't gone, or maybe, you know, for a while. So I was just lamenting that I haven't had antelope for a while earlier today. That's funny. She should ask that. So again, if it was done right, absolutely, you missed out. But again, it could have been one of those things like, well, okay, now I know I don't like it. Because it's delicious meat, and also too, and most of the hunters know, like if it's a clean kill, and you don't have, the animal doesn't run, it's going to be much better meat than if an animal is like, you know, if you have to track it, if it's wounded and it's got the adrenaline going. And so, and I still hang my, I age my deer. I did a long neck buck last year. Again, I hung it for 4 months in my, in a nice secluded spot outside, and just aged wonderfully. So I just, you know, I totally think that's a great thing to do if you can get away with it anyway.
Gene emailed, what's the difference in taste between squirrel and possum?
Oh, the texture. Squirrel is much more, the texture is number one thing, because there's smaller pieces where you can get larger pieces. Think of like chicken legs, like when you kind of pull chicken, you know, meat off a chicken leg or thighs. That's what kind of possum is like. And again, it depends on what the possum eats. They eat a bunch of stuff. They get into all sorts of stuff. So their meat is much more flavorful because of the variety of food that they eat. Where squirrels, acorns, nuts, just pretty much what they, you know, wherever they, the flavor of what they were eating, basically, going back to that we talked about earlier. So I think that possum is much more flavorful, and it can, and it's good in gumbo. I still have some.
And raccoon's pretty darn good, too.
Oh, I love it.
And on that note, we're out of time. Boy, the time flew by, Joel. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We'll do a longer stretch the next time you're on the air. How about that?
That sounds great. And have a wonderful holiday season. And look forward to talking with you again.
Chef Joel Olson of Hema Chef, a nationally recognized culinary instructor based in Madison, 30 years of teaching culinary skills to kids and youth and adults alike. Tomorrow on the show, we talk with the leaders of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection about the latest scams targeting holiday shoppers And we'll also talk about the new novella out. It's titled Star Song and written by Patricia Skalka, who we've had on many a time. And thank you very much for listening today. This and all of our shows are a team effort, including Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.